This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This week, agriculture is a huge industry in Illinois. That's why the Ag Director job's an important one, and a new director has taken over the role. We'll sit down with John Sullivan. He says his work will be about more than just farming.
If I can, and the state of Illinois can find opportunities for young people especially to stay in maybe where they were born and raised and hopefully raise their families there, grow the economy in those areas, I think that there would be no greater achievement than that.
Also coming up, more on a Central Illinois auto plant now under new ownership with a new approach to building vehicles. We'll hear about a school teacher empowering his students through the use of art and why time is such an issue among Illinois education policymakers. We'll also bring you Perry Klein's story from drugs to prison to college graduate. All that and more this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. This hour we have a conversation with the new state agriculture director. Also, why is the issue of time being so hotly debated when it comes to Illinois education policy? And it was a shock when Tim Lantis died a year ago. Most thought he was in good health. His widow looked for answers. She joins us on this week's Statewide. First up today, public school teachers are often urged to keep controversial topics out of the classroom, but one Illinois teacher is using art to inspire kids to speak out about injustices. Illinois Newsroom's Rachel Otwell reports.
I'm in the art room at Central Elementary School in Kewaunee. The town has around 12,000 residents. It's a 2.5-hour drive southwest of Chicago. Kids are working on tablets, writing summaries, and adding final touches to their projects. It's a people's history, highlighting marginalized figures from the past. Some 13 and 14-year-old students tell me about their pieces.
My poster was about women's rights during World War II. In 1941, it was when...
Mine is about the first Hispanic lady to go to space, Ellen Ochoa.
My poster is about the first gay pride parade. It was on June 28th, 1970.
The projects are just one of many ways Mark Nelson uses art to teach the kids about humanitarian causes and social justice. He uses a variety of mediums, from these digital posters to comic books to music and movies.
I want to show kids what art is really about, what artists do. When you talk to any artist, they're not just going to talk about their obsession with cadmium orange and that's it. They're going to talk about something that inspires them. And that's what I want to show them. That this is what artists do.
When he's not teaching art, Nelson creates artwork depicting lives ravaged by warfare and shares them on social media. He's earned international attention for his work. His latest focus is oil paintings of children and other victims of the war in Syria. Nelson's connected his class, mostly via Twitter, with two young Syrian sisters named Noor and Ala, who have an active account detailing what they've witnessed and begging for the carnage to stop. Last year, his students made a movie about the sisters' lives.
All we want to do is play, laugh, and learn together.
Eighth grader Miracle Sharo narrated the film from the perspective of the Syrian girls, with bombs going off around their home in Ghouta.
We love school. One day, our friend was killed with her mother while walking to school.
And so what was it like learning about their struggles and really getting to know them?
It was actually like really amazing and inspiring because I've never met anybody that has gone through any of that, like was scared to go to school and stuff like that.
And you still talk to them?
Yeah, I still talk to them every day almost.
Noor and Ala are now refugees in Turkey where they no longer face daily bombings. Nelson says his own interest in human rights was sparked as a child when his grandfather told him about his own experience as a refugee fleeing Ireland for America. For students in his class, social media makes current events more visible than ever, Nelson says. Plus, the junior high-aged kids he teaches are naturally interested in these topics.
When we came back from Thanksgiving break, a lot of my students had seen videos of the tear gassing. And of course, the images that were sticking in their mind were of kids.
Nelson says some of his students are immigrants from Mexico and Central America.
I showed them the images. We talked about what's going on. We talked about using language in a certain way. The way we paint people with words is really important. I'm not trying to push a political agenda, I'm trying to push a human agenda.
For Nelson, part of that human agenda means getting to know what his students worry about in their own lives. Petra Petty is a budding activist. She has cerebral palsy and uses a wheelchair. After having problems getting into the gym, she approached the principal about how to better the school's accessibility. She also successfully urged a local park to add a swing for those in wheelchairs.
When you're not handicapped, you don't think of that type of stuff.
She says it's her art teacher who bolstered her confidence to speak out.
I would like to speak for people who's afraid to.
For Nelson, his major lesson is to be a voice for the voiceless, and he shows these kids that speaking publicly about injustice and discrimination, even and sometimes especially through art, is empowering. I'm Rachel Otwell, Illinois Newsroom.
Illinois Newsroom is a public media collaboration covering education, politics, health, and the environment. When Illinois adopted a new school funding formula back in 2017, it was the culmination of a long effort involving a handful of complicated proposals. So perhaps it's no surprise a few details slipped through the cracks. But our education reporter Dusty Rhodes tells us one of those details was the clock.
What counts as a school day? Well, 5 clock hours of instructional time has been the law of the land in Illinois for as long as most people can remember. That's enough time for a half dozen classes, plus a passing period and lunch. But for reasons that no one has stated on the record, that provision disappeared when the new school funding formula took effect, leaving the minimum number of required instructional hours at 0. State Senator Jennifer Bertino Tarrant, a suburban Chicago Democrat and a former teacher and principal herself, quickly filed a bill to fix it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 28 reinserts a section of the school code that required an instructional day to be a minimum of 5 hours. This section was repealed in the Evidence-Based Funding for Student Success Act trailer bill.
This week, it got its first hearing before the Senate Education Committee. Testifying in favor was Sean Denny, lobbyist for the state's largest teachers union, who said his members are currently trying to negotiate contracts in the face of a new law that implies teachers are optional.
I can't think of a better analogy at this point, so I apologize, but all of the marbles have been pushed over into one part of the playing board. We have 0. All we're asking for is to even out the playing board again so we can hit the reset button and actually talk about these flexibilities in a light where there's not an entire group of people that have all the cards and we're coming to the floor with absolutely nothing.
But opponents to Bertino Tarrant's bill outnumbered supporters 5-1. Among those testifying against reinstating a set number of clock hours was the Illinois State Board of Education.
We have an opportunity to allow students to work in internships, job shadowing, cooperative work experiences. We have seen some increase in dual credit opportunities that may not just fit into what we have had as a common school day in the past. Some of these opportunities are available late afternoon, early evening. Some of these opportunities are available on a weekend.
That was Ralph Grimm, Chief Education Officer for the State Board. He sees freedom from clock hours not only opening opportunities for outside classes, but also as a way to accommodate students who aren't comfortable at school.
Those students who struggle within the walls of a school may actually thrive and do better working on their own, being engaged. Right now, if they're not in school, they're absent and or truant. For those students who struggle, who have anxieties, who have health issues, this perhaps is another way to meet their needs in a different fashion.
The wrangling went on for almost an hour, but some common ground emerged. For starters, all parties agreed that this issue should have been debated last spring before the old clock hour provision was repealed. And they all agree there's ample room for compromise, such as keeping a set minimum of clock hours for the lower grades, because let's face it, most third graders don't have internships. What they disagree about is whether the law needs to be changed back before those negotiations take place. Denny, the union guy, says yes.
I'm again making the commitment the next day. I will set up the meeting. I will provide the space. I will bring the coffee, whatever we need to do. I'm ready to go the next day.
Amanda Elliott, representing the state board, makes the same commitment, but she wants the negotiations to come first.
We would rather have the opportunity to sit down as soon as possible. You know, I'm also happy to bring coffee. We can meet tomorrow, whenever is convenient for everyone, to talk about ideas that we have. If, you know, there are concerns with how it's currently being implemented, we would just love the opportunity to sit down and talk about that before it's just put back in law.
In the end, the committee approved the bill unanimously, and the lobbyists for suburban Chicago districts promised to host negotiations. She also pledged to provide coffee. As of late Wednesday afternoon, nothing had been scheduled. I'm Dusty Rhodes.
Statewide can be heard on several stations throughout Illinois. A full listing is on our website at statewideshow.com. And this week, we welcome those of you who can now listen on WNIJ, Northern Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in. The electric automaker Rivian likes to talk about its new approach to battery-powered vehicles, autonomous driving, and internet-powered dashboard. But inside its normal manufacturing plant, there are still reminders that auto manufacturing is still auto manufacturing, even if gasoline has been replaced by electricity there. Ryan Denham talks to a former Mitsubishi worker who, like the plant itself, now has a second chance to make cars.
3 years ago, Wade Jensen punched the clock for the last time at Mitsubishi's manufacturing plant in Normal.
I remember taking pictures when I left, the day that I left, sitting in my car of the gate that I walked in every day for years, and making the social media comments, last day, on to new adventures, thinking you would never be back here again.
But here he is, once again. He's now engineering manager for Rivian's first assembly line, getting the electric automaker ready for production to begin next year. Of the 60 or so Rivian employees in Normal now, about half are former Mitsubishi workers like Jensen. He says it was surreal to walk back into the plant.
When you've done it for 28 years, it's your passion. I mean, it's what's in you. It's what's in your heart. It's your desire. And to have the opportunity to see this plant producing cars and putting them out the back door again, I was all in.
Jensen was eager to give me a tour of the Rivian plant last week. It's massive, around the size of 24 Walmarts. It looks even bigger now that it's so empty. Some sections are cordoned off by Rivian prep work. We cruise past lots of old Mitsubishi equipment that Rivian is deciding whether to sell, use, or scrap. It's a big difference from the days when Mitsubishi was cranking out 200,000 vehicles a year in the 90s and early 2000s.
We had a 52-second cycle time, so that means every 52 seconds, one car was moving from station to station. So our goal was to at least get one car a minute off the end of the line.
Rivian is planning to make 50,000 electric pickups and SUVs here, about a quarter of Mitsubishi's peak production. Jensen says that lower volume means Rivian won't be as heavily automated as Mitsubishi was. That begins later this year with what Rivian calls validation builds. They'll build around 70 vehicles on roll-around carts, static builds, they call them, instead of running them up and down the assembly line. Jensen says those 70 vehicles will then be divvied up for crash testing, manufacturing training, and other company needs.
This area we're coming up on to now.
My tour with Wade Jensen takes us to a well-lit, newly painted, but still very much empty section of the plant, a reminder that automakers' plans don't always come to fruition.
Back in Mitsubishi's time, in the early to mid 2000s, this was an expansion that Mitsubishi put on for their SUV. I don't know if you remember the Endeavor, the bigger SUV.
Oh, yeah.
Mitsubishi Endeavor. Uh-huh. This is where production for that vehicle was going to be done. But obviously, everybody knows what happened to the economy about that time, and everything started going south. Mm-hmm. And so this was never utilized for any of that. This is where it lends itself perfectly to Rivian's plan. This will become our first battery factory.
Those batteries will be the heart and soul of the new Rivian vehicles. Rivian says the biggest ones will give 400 miles of driving range on a single charge. They'll sit on a skateboard base that'll be shared across Rivian's vehicles, and maybe even sold to other companies that'll make their own electric vehicles with Rivian's technology. Rivian's battery manufacturing process is still being developed in Irvine, California, and then will be recreated here in Illinois.
So everything out in Irvine right now is their design, technical process development. working out all the bugs, fine-tuning it, and then from there, they'll decide on what equipment and what layout they need to move all that to the facility here.
For Jensen, this will be the second time he's been on the ground floor for a young automaker. He was hired in 1988 as a second shift supervisor at the Chrysler-Mitsubishi joint venture, known as Diamond Stars, when it first launched. He rose through the ranks, spending time in Japan to help launch cars. He became maintenance and engineering manager. But in 2015, he lost his job, just like 1,200 of his co-workers. Production was moved back to Japan.
It was kind of a shock to everybody. I'm sitting at home and start getting all these text messages and phone calls about, hey, are you seeing the news and what's going on? Of course, you kind of push it aside. But then the next day you come in and they make the official announcement in July that November of 15 would be the end of our production here.
In the last 3 years, the 56-year-old father of three bounced from job to job doing engineering work, most recently for a Caterpillar contract company in Pontiac, his hometown. 2 years ago, Rivian bought the plant from a liquidator for $16 million, a bargain price. It hired back a dozen or so maintenance guys, and Jensen's name kept coming up. Soon, he was hired too.
You know, to see normally aspirated cars and try to change my vision to electric cars 100% is not only a passion, but intriguing to me at the same time.
For now, Jensen says the hardest part is all the new lingo and acronyms. Mitsubishi's final assembly line, snaking north to south through the plant, is now called Rivian's general assembly line. Structure studies are now validation builds. Aside from those differences, Jensen sees a lot of similarities.
Anybody that you talk to that's in the automotive business, they all do the same things. They all know that there's prototype builds to prove out parts. There's tooling builds to prove out tooling. There's all these steps that you follow, and it's pretty much the same from company to company.
Rivian's hiring in Normal will ramp up throughout this year and next. It now has 600 employees company-wide, with most in Michigan, California, and the United Kingdom. To get its millions in local and state tax breaks, Rivian has promised to hire 1,000 full-time workers here in the next 5 years. That would make it one of McLean County's largest employers again. The first vehicles are scheduled to come off the assembly line in 2020. Jensen says he's excited to be back.
It's intriguing, and at the same time, some days it's a little daunting. But, you know, when you get my age, it sounds strange, but I'm not that far from retirement. But if I can keep doing this and stay this excited about it, I don't know when I'll retire.
From inside the Rivian plants, I'm Ryan Denham.
Still ahead on Statewide, a man in seemingly good health died a year ago. What signs might have been missed? We'll find out. Stay with us. This is Statewide. Coming up, a conversation with John Sullivan, former state lawmaker, now picked to head the state's Department of Agriculture. And last week, we told you about Perry Klein. He went from being a drug addict, in and out of prison, to graduating college. More on his story, that's still ahead. Next up, Tim Landis was a Springfield-based reporter. He died a year ago. Before then, there'd been little indication he had heart disease. He'd had an active lifestyle, ate a healthy diet, but an autopsy revealed he had years of untreated high blood pressure. His widow, Deborah Landis, wrote a first-person account of losing Tim and her investigation into the disease that took his life. It's our Illinois Issues report for this week. Maureen McKinney spoke with her.
When you found Tim, did that come as a shock because he'd lived such a healthy lifestyle?
It was evident he had died of a heart attack, and it was totally shocking because we had no clue that he had an existing heart problem that was later diagnosed as coronary artery disease. And it was very sudden, as the doctors have told us, that his glasses were still on. He was reading a book about the Amazon Corporation of Jeff Bezos.
When you were researching and conducting interviews for your story, you learned some things that you've described as stunning. And what were some of them?
Perhaps the most shocking was the fact that roughly 50% of people who have heart attacks do not experience any classic symptoms such as chest pain. That was stunning to me. And then also the fact that heart disease has been the number one killer of Americans since about 1930. And also the fact that Tim had high blood pressure for his entire adult life under the new blood pressure guidelines that the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology approved in November 2017. When I found these about the new guidelines, it certainly helped me understand why the autopsy findings revealed that he had died of coronary artery disease brought on by years of untreated hypertension.
With potentially half of heart attacks not having any prior symptoms classically, are there any obscure symptoms that may occur that you've learned about?
Women are said to have different sort of symptoms than men. For example, women may more often experience nausea or what feels like acid reflux or heartburn. They may have some back pain or shoulder pain as well. And more obscure symptoms include a sense of dizziness or lightheadedness, as well as a wound that doesn't seem to heal properly.
Did Tim have any of those obscure symptoms?
Yes, and that's something I'd like to tell or let everybody I know and people I don't know about, is that with any disease, and certainly heart disease too, you don't want to just chalk something up to, oh, I'm just getting older. For example, one night he woke up and he said that the room had felt dizzy to him. Then he got up and got a glass of water and then went back to bed. And he attributed that to, oh, he'd had a lot of coffee the day before. That could be it. It could have, you know, a lack of hydration. But perhaps it was also a sign of this heart problems that were occurring. And if I knew then what I know today, we would have hightailed it in to the emergency room. And then also he had, on one of his many hikes that he took, he had scratched himself. And that scratch didn't heal quite like, you know, one would think that it would heal. But we just, when things don't heal right, that could be indicative of a circulation problem. And also, just as weight loss can be indicative of a disease, sudden weight gain for no particular reason can be a possible sign of heart disease, because it shows that your body's retaining fluid because the heart's not working correctly. And that happened to Tim in the last couple months of his life here on Earth. But looking back, somebody who ate as good a diet, had as good a diet as he, got his kind of exercise, there's no reason that he should have been gaining weight. Again, in retrospect, I wish I could have just talked to Tim.
That's Deborah Landis. Her husband Tim passed away a year ago from a heart attack. She writes about his death and what she's learned about his condition. You can read more in our Illinois Issues feature for this week. It's available at our website, statewideshow.com. It's an interesting time for the State Department of Agriculture as it drafts new rules for a new industrial hemp program and what its role might be if a recreational marijuana plan passes. Add in the trade uncertainty felt by farmers, and new director John Sullivan has a lot to take on. With just about a week under his belt as the director, Sullivan, who's also a former state senator from Rushville, sat down with our reporter Jacqueline Driscoll to talk about how he's navigating the challenges and his priorities.
You have a background in agriculture, a family farm as well. How do you believe that your background helped you prepare for this particular role?
Oh, I think it was critical, actually, in preparing for this role, because to understand agriculture is to me such an important part of being the director of this agency, so that when somebody calls me up, or somebody, when I go to a meeting, they start asking me about livestock, about corn or soybeans or ethanol or whatever, that I just have that, an overview, an understanding of what the issue is. I think it gives you credibility as you try to move forward with, relating to that person or that topic or that subject. So, with the farming background, I think is very important. I think on top of that, my business experience. You know, I was running, being a partner and running a family business, auction business, in my case, real estate and auction business. I think that's certainly, you know, we had close to 50 employees, full-time employees. So I know what it takes to run a business and making payroll every month and you know, keeping finding good people to hire. And then the third thing, obviously my 14 years in the General Assembly on the legislative side, that's just the politics of the job. It's important to understand that as well. And I think, and once again, it just gives you a better understanding of what some of the requirements and needs are.
What are your biggest priorities in this role?
Well, initially, obviously, I'm trying to get my hands around the agency and try to figure out what all the requirements and needs of the agency are, duties and responsibilities are. And certainly as a director of Ag and the Department of Ag, a lot of our responsibilities are regulatory. So it's administrating and overseeing and making sure that both state and federal regulations and laws are followed. But it's another part of it is also trying to be being a spokesperson for agriculture, promoting agriculture. Priorities are trying to create better opportunities and more opportunities for rural development out in the obviously in the rural parts of the state. You know, one of the things that we've seen all over the state and obviously many other states as well is a loss of population in the in those rural areas. If I can and the state of Illinois can find opportunities for young people especially to stay in maybe where they were born and raised and hopefully raise their families there, and so that we can stabilize that those population losses, make for a better economy, grow the economy in those areas, I think that there would be no greater achievement than that.
You're coming into this position at a time that's recently been particularly difficult for agriculture and farmers. There's been trade uncertainty, the federal government shut down. How do you navigate that? And what message do you want to give to farmers and people within the industry here in Illinois?
Well, you know, if you're a farmer, you're an eternal optimist to begin with, right? You have to be. So, you know, every spring you put the seed in the ground, you know, you watch the livestock be born and you hope for the best. And so we are eternal optimists, number one. But number two, we've ridden the waves before, up and down. Gosh, we think back when the swine industry, just the bottom fell out of it, and really tough time then. You know, back in the 70s and the 80s, the commodity prices were extremely low and interest rates were extremely high. And so we've seen those challenges before. And we've always found ways to figure out a solution, to come up with a solution to the problem. That's one thing a farmer is very good at. And so we're in a tough time right now. There's no doubt about it. We have some really huge issues, commodity prices, trade issues that we are, government uncertainty. All those are factors that we are dealing with. But I think that because we're optimists, we know that there will be times better down the road. I do see the farm community getting more involved in government and in the process. And trying to make sure that their voices are heard. That's something that I stress everywhere I go and whoever I speak to, because we are a very small population. When you look at the number of producers, we're very small, even though our impact is huge, you know, through the ripple effect of taking our commodities from production out through the final wholesale resale process. So, you know, we're an optimistic bunch, and we'll get through these tough times like we have in the past.
Industrial hemp just passed by the General Assembly and signed into law. First question, I know that the Farm Bureau has been attempting to push an industrial hemp bill for quite some time. Were you there and were you an advocate for this? And then second part of that question, farmers have been dealing with declining crop prices for years now. Is this an opportunity to kind of offset some of that? You mentioned that there has been a lot of excitement around it.
Yeah. So first of all, I was certainly involved with the hemp discussion, possible legislation when I was in the Senate, but it just was not on, wasn't on top of anybody's wish list. I don't know really why. There were some people that really pushed it very hard and others that it just, I don't know why it never really made it any further than it did. But I will say that right now there does seem to be a tremendous amount of enthusiasm for it. And I do believe it's because, number one, it can give us another commodity to sell. And anytime we can diversify our portfolio, we're going to reduce risk and it's going to give us other opportunities. And so I think that's number one. Number two, and it kind of goes back to our earlier discussion with regard to rural development, I think that it could give some opportunities for some farmers, maybe not some large farmers, but some smaller operations. You know, a half acre or an acre or 5 acres, you know, that to grow hemp on, that it will give us some other smaller farmers really some opportunities to, you know, stay involved with agriculture.
You're listening to Statewide, and I'm Jacqueline Driscoll sitting down with the new director of agriculture, John Sullivan. Recreational marijuana is very different from hemp, which we were just talking about, but also an important discussion throughout the state at this particular time. The Department of Agriculture will likely be in charge of regulating cultivation sites. Is that going to create a larger burden on the department? Is this department capable of doing that if a bill does pass?
Oh, I think it absolutely would. I mean, number one, I think we would be the logical agency to oversee the growing and the cultivating of marijuana like we do now with the medical marijuana. And so we have a lot of people that have become knowledgeable and I think could transition into the recreational marijuana if that does happen. But I think how large of an industry this is going to be or could become, I mean, we've heard some tremendous numbers. If it does get to, as it does grow, it's going to simply take more personnel and more manpower. And so we're going to need more resources. So as that discussion moves forward, I certainly hope to be able to contribute and add to the conversation and to stress to the lawmakers, if this is going to happen, what kind of resources that we as a department are going to need to oversee it.
Will you be a part of negotiations moving forward?
You know, I don't know about negotiations. Certainly hope to have some input. You know, if a legislator or if the governor's office reaches out and says, you know, John, we're talking about this specific aspect of marijuana and the production of it in the state. What's your thoughts or what kind of impact is that going to have on the department? I would hope that I could give my input and insight into it. I'm not going to go out and stand on a bandwagon and say this is what we want. I don't think that's our role, but if they do ask for our input, certainly we want to be able to inject that.
Last week we saw Governor Pritzker sign Illinois into the U.S. Climate Agreement. Mm-hmm. I know that a lot of people are very excited about this. This creates new opportunity, but we're seeing in the Northeast some negotiations with solar panels and companies wanting to purchase farm ground to build those panels because it's easier to acquire, it's cheaper. Mm-hmm. Obviously, agriculture is really important to our state, and the farm ground is very important to farmers. How do we navigate that, and will we make sure that our agriculture is preserved?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, first of all, you know, private land ownership is something that I think all people take, that is very important, right? So if a landowner decides that they want to use their land for solar farms, certainly I think they ought to have that right and opportunity. I think the department's role in that, as we, you know, kind of have been with wind farms and other siting of properties like that, is to make sure that there is an ag mitigation agreement out there so that landowners know what they're getting into and that their property is protected and that there is an avenue that if at some point down the road that solar farm is going to be removed and demolished, that the land is brought back to the same condition that it was prior to that. So I do think solar seems to be a lot of interest in solar. Obviously, you know, we start talking about renewable energy, we know why. But, you know, whenever you're taking land out of production, there's always a concern, less acres in production, you know, less opportunities for grain and other commodities to be grown. But again, I think as we become more efficient in our production, I think it's just important that we value the landowner's needs and wants, and then make sure that we as an agency can help mitigate, make sure that those solar farms are put in and handled in a proper and a fair way.
I want to quickly circle back to the partial government shutdown. We are opening up for a few weeks at least. Previously, FSA offices had been closed, and that was very concerning for farmers who were looking for input loans to get their seed in the ground. Also, challenges for beginning farmer loans. As this voice for agriculture and farmers, how do you handle that moving forward?
You know, we obviously, we're going to try to do a better job of educating the public as to keep them updated and educated as to what's going on, maybe trying to promote dates, you know, deadlines, for example, as to when something, a program or a signature or a clarification of acreage or whatever, to make sure that those dates are known to the producers and the farmers. I think the last one kind of caught some people off guard. I actually had some folks come up to me and say there's some programs to reimburse farmers for the loss from the results of the trade wars. And some folks didn't get in and get that work done. I know one very close that didn't get it done because I didn't get in and get my paperwork done. And then, of course, there was a shutdown, and that could very much have had a negative impact on some individuals. We've done some things behind the scenes, you know, where we've tried, when the government shutdown was going on, as I said in my earlier comments, you know, the department was able to come in and work with the meat inspectors, the federal meat inspectors who were not getting paid, but to help find a revenue source for them so that they could stay on the job to make sure that processing plants didn't have to shut down because they can't operate unless they have meat inspectors there. So we will continue to try to find, you know, some opportunities where we can, in the event of another shutdown, that we can try to mitigate those damages as much as possible.
The new agriculture director in the state of Illinois, John Sullivan, talking with our Jacqueline Driscoll. You can find that full interview available at statewideshow.com. Up next, a story of perseverance and overcoming the odds. Stay with us on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Perry Klein didn't think he was college material. He has a felony record, and like many people he went to prison with, he didn't finish high school. But Klein, who's 51 years old, beat the odds. In a follow-up to a story we brought you last week, Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines has this profile.
Perry Klein's story starts in Chicago. He grew up there, lived with his mom, a social worker. He says he was a good kid, got good grades, and he loved playing basketball. But all that changed his freshman year of high school. It was an incident that affected the way other people saw him and the way Klein saw himself.
So it was like one day we were like hanging out at my grandma's, and we decided we go to this other place that's close to where I live at called Pershing Park. And we go over there and play on these little bitty rims because they were so low. We were like excited so we can go dunk and play basketball and, you know, feel like we're bigger than what we really are. And it was like a ritual. We usually always go there like probably two times a week. So I had one of my friends that lived close to me. We were walking together, this guy named Larry. So we were walking, you know, we got to the street called King Drive. And the police, they like just pulled right up on us. Larry started running, and that's what we do. You know, from where we from, we didn't really trust the police. But he started running. I didn't feel like we had any reason to run, so I didn't run. So they put me in a car and they went to go chase him down, and nevertheless, they caught him. And they took us to this lady house, and you know, she came downstairs, he rung the bell, she came downstairs, and he asked her, was it one of these guys? And she didn't point out Larry, she pointed out me. She said it was him. And I was like, I said, I never seen this lady a day in my life. She said that I had a gun, and she said we robbed her of her books and her purse or something like that. And searched this and all that. We didn't have anything. We never seen this lady a day in our lives. So they took us to the police station, and they called our parents. I was just continuing to tell, I didn't do nothing. We didn't do nothing. They released me to my parents, and they gave me a court date. And I think it was like a couple of days after Thanksgiving. And I remember playing basketball, and we had a basketball game. So I had all my uniform and all that. I was like, all right, after this, I'm going to go. And we got a game. I never made it to that game. I went to court. You know, the judge found me guilty for some reason. I don't remember because he told me to tell the story. And I remember being terrified telling this story. And like I said, the lady pointed me out. So they decided to, reprimand me. Yeah, and they sent me to Valley View. And that's what I did, like, my time. But I didn't complete the sentence because they ended up finding a person who was doing the robberies over there. And they sent me back to court. They let me go home with my mom. And when I got back, people were like kind of in awe that I was like in jail. You know where I'm coming from? It's like, oh man, he was locked up, man. And so that tough exterior took over me, you know. And I started to like transform into something I really wasn't. I started to act out in a lot of ways. You know, and I really didn't feel like I had a lot of support from the school because of that traumatic experience. You know, nobody came to me and gave me any counseling. Nobody came to me and say, how did you get through this? You know, I didn't go to a school like that. And when I got back to school, it was like my basketball coach and some of the teachers, they were looking at me in a different way. they didn't let me play basketball, and that was like one of my passions, playing basketball with my friends, those same people I was growing up with and playing with after school or before school. So it was like now I had to like find a new different set of friends at the same time they didn't practice, and now I'm out in the streets. So I'm starting to hang out with these older people, you know, and I started like coming under peer pressure, coming under all these different little dynamics from the streets. So I started taking on that street trait life, you know, trying to fit in. And it was just an ongoing cycle. I didn't know really who I was and didn't really know what I wanted to do, you know. And then hanging in the streets, you started to like seeing things, you started getting into things. I felt like it was a hopeless situation at first. And then I started like committing crimes, you know, hanging out with people, they get these bright ideas. And it got to a point where it's like, man, I started going back and forth to jail and then start getting caught up in the system.
Klein was in and out of Illinois prisons throughout the 1990s. And when he was released, he got addicted to heroin. It was something his brother struggled with, too. And in 2006, his brother died of an overdose.
When he passed away, we were at his funeral. And I had a friend to go over there and get me some heroin because I didn't want to feel the pain no more. You know, it was like, it was bad. And we were like carrying my brother's casket. And I think that's when I like used it. And I snorted it. And we were in a limo. It's my mom, my girl, and my aunt. And all I remember is waking up in the hospital while we were going to bury him. And when I woke up, I just seen my mom, my aunt sitting there, and you know, tears just start coming out my eyes. Like, man, how could this just happen? And it was sad, man. And then I just told my mom, just go bury my brother, and I'll see you guys at the reception. And it was real humiliating experience. I was just thinking about my mom the whole time because I was like, man, how can I do this to her like that, you know? And I got through that point, but I still wasn't done. It was like that chase and that run, you know, trying to run away from my pain, trying to run away from my feelings, not dealing with my brother. You know, I never knew about people could help you, you know, with this kind of stuff. You know, I never been in therapy. You know, I didn't know about that.
Klein kept using heroin for years after his brother's death. He says it was his way of dealing with the pain. But something happened in 2013 that would change the course of Klein's life.
You know, I was like with one of my friends, you know, he was in a wheelchair and we were together all the time. He's my using buddy. We were getting high one day and it was like, man, money was getting short and wanted some more. And I seen him just sitting right, like I'm sitting here and he's like sitting on the other side of the table and he's just got his eyes closed and he's rocking his head and he's like mumbling and moaning. And I'm like, man, what's wrong with you? You know, he's like, I'm all right. I was like, man, something wrong with you. You know, and he had this heroin sitting on top. I said, man, you don't want this because you don't think you want this. You know, and I used it. And he had like $10 like rolled up. I think he was snorting out of it. And I took it and I went to go get some more heroin. And I told him I was coming back. But I really had no intention of coming back because I was like, I'm going to do this one. He don't need it anymore. And as I was walking out the door walking down the street, I seen Mike, this one mutual friend of ours. And I said to Mike, I said, man, go down there and check on Tall, man. Look like he's dying. And I remember telling him that clear as day. And I didn't go back down there that day. But Mike called me the next day. And he said, Perry, you were right. See, he died. I was like, what? And it's like, crushed me. It's like, man. You know, I was like, what the hell, what just happened? You know, I could have saved him, you know, but I was thinking about getting that next one. And that was like the beginning of the end of this craziness, you know. I remember getting down on my knees, you know, I remember praying to God and asking me to get me out of this madness. And he did, like right away. I started praying and I had like a little computer in my room and I started looking at Facebook and stuff like that and I started seeing all these different things, and I seen a little passage. I seen the passage from my cousin. It was a passage, and it said, trust in the Lord with all thy heart, lean not on understanding, and always acknowledge him, and he'll direct your path. But when I synced it, it had meaning to me. And then I took it so to heart. I was like, man, I was like, something got to happen.
And something did happen. Klein got out of Chicago. An old girlfriend bought him a bus ticket to Champaign. It was the change of scenery he says he needed. When he arrived in Champaign, Klein was homeless and in withdrawal.
So I started staying in the shelter. So I stayed in the shelter and I went to meetings, Narcotics Anonymous, and I started to meet people in the meetings. And these people were like giving me good directions, and I was taking suggestions for them, and I was believing in God because God got me. So my whole faith, was like really, really, is real strong. So, and I trusted in that. And I ended up taking a suggestion from a friend because I used to always tell him, man, I said, man, I'm gonna go back to school one day. And he was in a fellowship one day. I was helping him move, and after we got through moving, he drove me right up to Parkland College. And he said, get out. He said, go register for school. And I did it. And I went in there, I registered for school, did everything they asked me to do, because it was like foreign to me. I was like, I got to go where? I got to go here, there. I was like, oh, man. And then I had to go take a placement test, go see a guidance counselor. I didn't even do none of that in high school, So it was kind of different, and I was like, I'm finishing everything. I'm not giving up anymore on nothing, and that's the way I looked at it. So I stuck in there and I just was like showing up, just like I was showing up to the meetings, like they were helping me get better. And I found myself not dope sick anymore. And I start feeling good about myself, and I start completing things, and I start like feeling like really good. So I had like built my confidence up, and I had a support system through the self-help group, Narcotics Anonymous. People were like really supporting me. And then I started getting support from school, and they was showing me all these different resources that I could use. And I was still homeless at the time too. I was still staying in the homeless shelter, going to school, going to these meetings, but it was like my resources to help me get to where I need to be.
Even with that support, it wasn't easy. Klein struggled to pass some of his courses. One subject was especially challenging for him.
Math was like my worst subject ever. So I had like started like real low in math. It's like straight humiliation. So I started asking for help, and I asked for help, and I asked for help, and people were glad to help me because I wasn't scared to ask for help, because being in that Narcotics Anonymous program, that's the first thing they tell you, a closed mouth don't get fed. So if people don't know what's wrong with you, how are they going to help you? So I was like, okay, I'm gonna ask for help. Miss Martin, she stand out to me so much. I love that lady so dearly, Dr. Erin Martin Wilding. She didn't like cut no slack with me. And when I passed her class, I passed it with a D. She didn't cut no slack with me, but it was so hard. So I had like two or three semesters in a row, because she was always there, and she would say, come to my office hours. And I would go to office hours every day. And we would be there, and I would get frustrated. And I would be like, look, Ms. Martin, we go back and forth. And then I'd make me mad. I'll leave, walk out, come back. Hey, I'm sorry. Let's do it again. It was like that the whole time. But she never gave up on me. But I stuck it out. Was there every day, passing the test and going to the next level. These things started being exciting to me. And then I started getting like good grades, and I'm like, oh, okay. People started like supporting me, being supportive, and then I end up graduating.
Klein earned his associate's degree from Parkland College in 2016. With the help of an advisor there, he got into the University of Illinois' School of Social Work. And last December, Klein achieved something he used to think was out of reach. He graduated from college.
Perry Klein.
That's Klein walking across the stage at his graduation from the U of I. Thanks to his experiences at Parkland and at the U of I, Klein now knows what he wants to do with his life, and that's helping people, especially people like him, people whose stories he can relate to. Klein doesn't believe he's an exception either. He says there's more people out there like him. And an education could help them, too.
Getting more people that from prison, like in the educational programs, that's the key, because that opens up the floodgates, for people to like continue to have hope, If I wouldn't have been to Parkland, it wouldn't have been no University of Illinois. You know, Parkland is everything to me. I love Parkland. So I think it's a beautiful thing that God gave me the opportunity to be a part of. You know, coming from where I came from, I think it's a miracle.
Klein now has a job helping people overcome addiction. And he helped create a charity that provides housing for people trying to get clean. He says he's going to get his master's degree next. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
That story produced with help from the Education Writers Association's fellowship program. That's it for Statewide this week. Join us next time. And if you missed any of this episode or past episodes, they're all available at our website, statewideshow.com. Crawford. Statewide's a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.